Hello there. Today is Tuesday, October the 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a whistleblower, a second one, corroborates allegations that sparked an impeachment investigation. Even the president's staunchest allies now are angry over a surprise announcement on Syria strategy.
The Kurds stepped up when nobody else would to fight ISIS. If we abandon them, good luck getting anybody to help America in the future with radical Islam, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS.
Also ahead, climate protesters block roads in cities around the world. It's all on today's International Edition. As House Democrats fire off more subpoenas, the White House is finalizing a high-stakes strategy to counter the impeachment threat to President Donald Trump. Stall, obfuscate, attack.
It's a big scam, and I think Adam Schiff should be investigated for what he did. He took to the great chamber, Congress, and he made a speech. And his speech was a fraud. Everything he said was a fraud.
But some of the president's defenses that the whistleblower's complaint are hearsay may not work now, as a second whistleblower with firsthand knowledge of the situation has also come forward. AP White House correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Well, first of all, the impeachment inquiry is a scam. The conversation that I had with the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, was a very good it was a very cordial, very good conversation. The mistake they made, the opponents, the opposition, the Democrats, the radical left, deep state, whatever you want to call them, they came out with a whistleblower report before they saw the conversation.
Here's Sagar Magani with more. Okay. House Democrats, for their part, issued a new round of subpoenas on Monday. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office also released an open letter signed by 90 former national security officials who served in both Democratic and Republican administrations, voicing support for the whistleblower who raised concerns about Trump's efforts to get Ukraine to investigate political foe Joe Biden. The letter follows repeated attacks from the president against the whistleblower. And it's a big enough concern that lawmakers are now considering taking drastic steps to protect the whistleblower, including limited who is present during the possible testimony and disguising the person's voice and image, among other things. Joining us now to discuss is someone who knows a lot about the intelligence community. That is former Central Intelligence Agency officer Jack Rice. He's currently a criminal defense attorney. Jack, thank you for being with us. How unprecedented would these efforts to disguise the whistleblower be?
This is absolutely unheard of. We have U.S. intelligence officers who have sworn an oath to protect the Constitution of the United States. And so their obligation is to tell the truth to Congress or anybody else that they're actually testifying in front of, or if they're talking to the president. At the same time, what we're finding right now is that these very same whistleblowers are being targeted by the president, who is attacking them incessantly, going after them, calling them traitors, talking about treason. And what that does to certain segments of society is like something we have never seen before. The fear of people going after them physically or trying to kill them, that's a real serious threat. And there are people who are justifiably concerned about it.
How much danger could a whistleblower be in, potentially, if they are exposed?
If a whistleblower is exposed in this environment, and based upon what we have seen from others who have been whistleblowers in the past, there is the potential that people will actually try to kill them. This is not an exaggeration. We have seen efforts in the past or people who have talked about this very publicly. And again, when you get a president who calls them traitors, talking about treason, this puts that at a completely different level. Again, this is something we have never seen before.
Is it against the law? Aren't we legally bound to protect whistleblowers that come forward to report corruption in our government?
Yes, we are. In fact, we have federal protections in place to protect whistleblowers, and there's been one Republican senator who has come forward in support of those whistleblowers themselves, and that's Senator Grassley. In fact, he is one of those who has come forward again and again on this issue because because he acknowledges just how critically important it is to have people who are on the inside, the inner workings of government, who see something fundamentally wrong, whether it's left or right. And he's a Republican who's saying we have to protect this issue and this institution of sorts. So there is a law in place that's designed to protect this. But what we have seen from a president like this is he is willing to do what he needs to do to go after the messenger if he can't go after the message.
That seems to be the case with many of the president's allies. We heard from Republican Ron Johnson, who initially had made statements saying he was very concerned about the president's call with Ukraine and potentially bargaining congressionally approved security funding if he would, you know, investigate a political opponent, Joe Biden. Now, Mr. Johnson was on a major network saying he does not trust our FBI or CIA, Federal Bureau of Investigation or Central Intelligence Agencies. You're a former Central Intelligence agent. What does this say about the current state of our political climate when our own lawmakers don't trust our intelligence agencies?
When I used to walk into the Central Intelligence Agency, there's a wall that has stars carved into it. And every star represents an officer who was killed in the line of duty. And many of those stars have no names on them, because what we have done is we have sworn an oath to protect the country and to give our lives if we needed to do that. When I see politicians say things like this to men and women who have literally given all and are willing to give all, and I don't say this very often, this turns my stomach, because this isn't just about politics. Sometimes when you walk into the Beltway, everything is about politics. But for the men and women who work at Pentagon, who work in the intelligence community, who work at Justice, many of whom have lost their lives, sacrificed everything, their families are in pieces because of the work that they do, to see a politician who simply flippantly rolls this out there because they've decided they want to protect a particular party is something that makes me sick. And if I heard it from somebody on the left, it would make me sick on that side too, because it doesn't make any difference. When you die, you don't die as a Republican. You don't die as a Democrat. In this case, I would argue if it were to happen, it's because you're a patriot who's actually trying to make your country better instead of about making your party better.
And how dangerous is it for the country when we've got lawmakers openly saying they don't trust our intelligence? I would imagine that it's dangerous when the president says it, which he has repeatedly since the Russia investigation began. And now with lawmakers, some of them, or at least we know of one, making that statement outwardly, does that also pose a risk for the well-being of our intelligence agents?
I'm very concerned about these constant attacks that we have seen over years now. And I'm not talking just about going after the press because the president doesn't like what they say. I'm not just talking about early on, he was going after the Department of Defense. Then he was going after Justice, then the FBI specifically, then the CIA. Anybody and everybody who has ever said anything against him, he somehow turns them into not just enemies, but anti-American. The real problem that we have when you do that again and again is the American people start to doubt the legitimacy of their government. And when that happens, it undercuts the foundation of who we are as a people. And that's something we really need to be concerned about, because this president will come and this president will go. One more term, he'll do another term, maybe, maybe not. There'll be somebody after them. But the problem is that the American people will continue to doubt their foundation of their country. And that really is something that is very difficult to let go of once it starts. That's the deterioration of the country itself.
It's former Central Intelligence Agency officer and currently a criminal defense attorney, Jack Rice. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The diplomat at the center of the Trump impeachment inquiry has quit the McCain Institute as the director. The former ISIS suspects languish in camps to avoid rearrest. Immigration protesters shout down the acting director of Homeland Security in the U.S. And free, fair, and peaceful elections for Mozambique? No way, according to analysts. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump is defending his decision to pull back U.S. troops from northern Syria, clearing the way for an expected Turkish assault and essentially abandoning Kurdish fighters who fought alongside American forces to defeat the Islamic State.
Many people agree with it very strongly, and I understand both sides of it. I fully understand both sides of it. But I campaigned on the fact that I was going to bring our soldiers home.
Well, the move drew immediate outrage from some of the Republican president's closest allies in Congress, including Senator Lindsey Graham, who called the decision a disaster.
This impulsive decision by the president has undone all the gains we've made, thrown the region into further chaos. Iran is licking their chops. And if I'm an ISIS fighter, I've got a second lease on life.
Well, Trump's decision to pull back U.S. troops from northern Syria clears the way for an expected Turkish assault and essentially abandons Kurdish fighters. Joining us to talk more about it, Amy Austin Holmes, visiting scholar for Harvard's Middle East Initiative and a fellow at the Wilson Center's Middle East program. Thank you for being with us. Talk to us a bit about why this is getting so much anger, even from the president's closest allies.
What we're seeing now is, in a way, a repeat of what happened in December when Trump also made the sudden withdrawal announcement without consulting any of his national security team. Back in December, it was shortly before Christmas, he suddenly announced U.S. troops would be withdrawn from Syria. And that led to the resignation of Secretary Mattis and also the special envoy to Syria and heading the Defeat ISIS coalition. And now he's again done the same thing, that after a phone call with President Erdogan, without consulting anyone in the Pentagon or apparently any of his other team, he's again decided that the U.S. will just be allowing Turkey to move forward. And this is really problematic because he's essentially making major U.S. foreign policy decisions without consulting his own team.
How big of a security risk would this be for the United States itself?
It could potentially be a risk to the United States because the Syrian Democratic Forces, who have been our partner force in northeast Syria, they now control a territory that is about the size of West Virginia. It's like three times the size of the country of Kuwait. It's a large territory, and they control this region. It is the first time in over 7 years that this one-third of Syria has been free of the Islamic State and free of Assad. The regime of Assad only has a very small presence, but for the most part, one-third of Syria, where the SDF is relatively safe and it's relatively stable, and all of that could be jeopardized by a Turkish intervention. The risk to the United States is that the SDF, as they captured territory from the Islamic State, they also took in ISIS fighters who they captured, and they're now holding them in a detention facility. And if the SDF has to fight off a Turkish invasion, they may not be able to devote the same number of forces to protecting that camp, the Al-Hol camp that's holding the ISIS detainees. And so, I mean, just imagine, you've defeated the horrific terrorist organization, the Islamic State Caliphate. You now have them in a detention facility in Al-Hol camp, and they could escape from there. They could be released if they don't have the personnel to hold them because of this Turkish intervention. And then releasing all of these jihadis that have just recently been captured after the liberation in Baghouz, the last battle that was in March, after that stronghold was cleared. And so it's really a horrible decision that Trump has made. It's a gift, essentially, to Iran and Russia, who are supporting the regime of Assad. It, I assume, will embolden the regime in Damascus to continue retaking territory. And it's just extremely, extremely irresponsible. And, of course, it's also a huge betrayal to our partners in the SDF.
And I know you've been doing a lot of research on these Syrian rebels. Tell us a little bit about what you've learned.
I've been doing a survey, actually, of the Syrian Democratic Forces. To my knowledge, it's the very first survey that's ever been done of the SDF, and we often talk about them as Kurds or the Kurdish forces, but as they captured more and more territory from the Islamic State, they incorporated more and more Arab and also Christian. There's a Christian minority there. The Syriac, Assyrian, and Chaldean Christian in northern Syria have also joined the SDF. There's a small Yazidi minority, a small Turkmen minority, who have also joined the SDF. And so really, it's no longer accurate to actually say the Kurds or Kurdish forces. It's actually a multi-ethnic, multi-religious force, and it reflects the diversity of this region of Syria. And, which I've seen myself through the time I've spent over there, the fact that they're able to work together, side by side, Kurds and Arabs, Christians, Muslims. Frankly, it's something that I think many other militaries in the Middle East and in the world, frankly, could learn from.
What happens if Kurds start being slaughtered by the Turkish? What does that tell the world about the United States' commitment commitment to keeping its word and supporting its allies.
Well, it sends a horrible signal. It sends a signal that we will not defend and stand by our allies. They have paid a huge price. Over 11,000 members of the SDF have been killed in the fight against the Islamic State. I visited cemeteries all across the region where, you know, they're buried. I mean, it's a huge sacrifice on the part of the SDF. And now, you know, they finally achieved some kind of relative stability. And I'm just really worried that all of that will be jeopardized and that their trust in us as a partner will be lost.
How unusual is it for a president to just go and make a decision like this without listening or getting any advice from his national security team?
What we saw on previous presidents, they had a process for making decisions like this. And that's why they have national security advisors. That's why they have the National Security Council. That's why they have, you know, a whole team of advisors who have deep expertise on these issues and who they should consult in situations like this. And the fact that Trump prefers to listen to the advice of foreign leaders instead of his own American team is deeply disturbing. This is very unusual. You know, I can't think of a precedent where something like this happened in previous administrations, something of this magnitude. And so this is why we've seen so many people in Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, come out against this. Personally, I hope that they will be able to get him to reconsider this decision, because it's just potentially devastating for Northeast Syria and for what it says about our commitment to our allies, not only in the Middle East, but around the world.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Thank you for being with us. That's Amy Austin Holmes. She is a visiting scholar at Harvard's Middle East Initiative and a fellow at the Wilson Center's Middle East Program. All-star American basketball player James Harden of the Houston Rockets apologized Monday to the team's Chinese fans after Rockets general manager Daryl Morey posted a message on Twitter supporting anti-government protesters in Hong Kong.
Yeah, we apologize. You know, we love China. We love, you know, playing there. I know for both of us individually, we go there, you know, once or twice a year. They show us the most important love. So, you know, we appreciate them as a fan base, and we love everything, you know, they're about. And you know, we appreciate the support that they give us individually and as an organization. So, you know, we love you.
Well, Morey deleted the post and tweeted an apology after pushback from the Rockets owner as the club faced losing one of the NBA's most lucrative markets. The Rockets are in Japan to play a couple of preseason games. In response to Morey's tweet, the Chinese Basketball Association announced it was canceling a cooperation agreement with the Rockets. Chinese star Yao Ming, who played his entire Hall of Fame career with the Rockets before retiring with injury, is currently chairman of the CBA. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Mark Hyman, professor of sports management at George Washington University, what this all means on a larger scale.
Western professional sports leagues are all seeking fans outside of their home countries. And, you know, all are becoming global in search of new revenue streams and new fans. China, of course, is an extremely important market to these professional sports leagues for a very obvious reason. There are 1.4 billion people in China. It's potentially the largest market for the NBA, the NFL, Major League Baseball, and the National Hockey League. And if these leagues want the cooperation of the Chinese government, they may have to accept that some topics are off limits. And I think we're in a period where leagues are learning. There's a learning curve to kind of understand what topics are going to be, you know, draw reaction from the Chinese government and which are not. And clearly, Dale Morey's text, or rather Dale Morey's tweets about the protests, ongoing protests in Hong Kong, crossed that line. But again, you know, sports are entering a new, professional sports are entering a new phase where the fan bases and the scope, the reach of professional sports have become so global that they're in an entirely new set of issues for league officials, for commissioners and club officials to navigate. I think this is one example.
Well, now comes the controversy. The controversy being that immediately the owner of the Houston Rockets and the NBA apparently had something to do with the general manager of the Rockets pulling his tweet and apologizing, and everybody else apologizing to the Chinese. Now, from the U.S. Capitol come lawmakers on both sides of the aisle saying, wait a minute, hold on, you shouldn't be accepting money over human rights and the way things are run. How does that fall into place?
The NBA is a business, and the owners of NBA franchises are looking to China as a large and increasingly larger source of revenue. The number of fans in China who are rabid NBA fans is just amazing. The NBA Finals typically draws an audience on mobile alone of more than 200 million viewers in China. There are more followers, social media followers of the NBA on Weibo, 41 million, than on either Facebook or Twitter. So it's a business calculation for the NBA, how to preserve the fan base and its presence in China, while at the same time maintaining its credibility and demonstrating to fans and others that there is a social conscience as well. So it's a very difficult dance to negotiate for the NBA. I'm sure Commissioner Adam Silver of the NBA this is a challenge, and one that I think he's going to be facing increasingly over the years as he tries to maintain relationships with the Chinese government, yet at the same time demonstrating that the NBA is a progressive league that allows players and others to have a voice.
Is this going to be long-lasting? Are the Houston Rockets, which is, from what I understand, one of the most popular teams in China, that's where Yao Ming played, and now Yao Ming is head of the China Basketball right. Association. Is this going to go away, or is this just going to repeat and grow bigger?
I think that the NBA and the Chinese government will navigate this crisis, and that the NBA will continue to be available to basketball fans in China. But looking long-term, issues like this one are not going to go away. I mean, the NBA players and to an extent NBA officials are well known for using social media platforms to speak out and to share their views on issues. So it would not surprise for this to continue to be a source of tension in the relationship between not only the NBA, but all professional Western sports leagues and the Chinese government.
Well, the NBA released a statement saying that the comments made by the Rockets general manager have regrettably offended many of its friends and fans in China. But it also said that the values of the league support individuals sharing their views on matters that they feel are important. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. Three men have won the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine for their findings on how cells sense and adapt to oxygen availability. Gracie Jerome reports.
Three men who made discoveries relating to how our bodies respond to oxygen have been awarded the 2019 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. The Secretary General of the Prize Committee, Thomas Perlman, made the announcement on Monday morning.
The Nobel Assembly at Karolinska Institutet has today decided to award the 2019 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine jointly to William Kaelin, Sir Peter Ratcliffe, and Greg Semenza.
The Institute says the scientists, two from the US and one from the UK, established the basis for understanding how oxygen levels affect cellular metabolism and physiological functions.
That's Gracie Jerome reporting. 21-year-old Marilyn Zarkaya is one of the players in the new Sudanese Women's Football League that launched a few weeks ago. She came from South Sudan to follow her dream in Khartoum, but is worried about whether Sudan's conservative society will accept women's football after decades of restrictions. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
Marlene Zakaria has been passionate about playing soccer since she was a child. The 21-year-old left her family in South Sudan to pursue the sport in Sudan, where a new women's league began playing on September 30th.
I was playing in Wau, Bahar Ghazal State, and then I came to Khartoum and joined Tahadi team with coach Sarah Edward. Before the league started, I had some study issues, so I stopped and then moved to Tahadi, to Kornk team.
It took 3 decades of battling obstacles and objections to launch the Women's League, which is sponsored by Sudan's Ministry of Youth and Sports. It is still not easy for some of the women players. Zakaria says people insult her when she wears the football uniform in public.
One of the difficulties I always face is that I love to wear the football uniform when I go for training. I face people's beliefs and opinions. They ask, am I a boy or a girl, and why I look like this, and why we look masculine. They also say even men couldn't win cups, so we wouldn't do anything.
Critics of the Women's League are also active on social media. Analysts say they are fueled by the Islamist government of former President Omar al-Bashir, which restricted women's rights.
Because when the former regime came to power, they targeted women with laws and local public orders to send them back home. So I don't think it's non-acceptance, more than an accumulated social culture for 30 years. We need to change it.
Due to concerns the game would cause unrest, riot police have been on hand for the opening matches. However, the games have come off without any problems.
We didn't expect that both females and males will attend the matches, but it happened, and everything is going well till now. We hope for the league to continue the same way it started, and we hope to form a national team in order to represent Sudan worldwide.
Zakaria says her mother supported her dream and convinced her father to embrace it too before she came to Khartoum. She hopes people change their minds on what women should be allowed to do, like play football, during the transition to what she calls a new Sudan. Naba Mohideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
Rip Taylor, the madcap mustached comedian with a fondness for confetti throwing, became a television game show mainstay in the 70s, has died. Margie Sarzaletta reports.
You might remember Rip Taylor as the zany guy with the mustache who threw confetti at everyone. He got his start as the crying comedian. He told UPI in 1992 when his jokes bombed with audiences in the Catskills, he pretended to cry as he begged them to laugh, and it worked. Taylor hosted the $1.98 Beauty Show in the late 1970s and did guest appearances on The Monkees, The Tonight Show, Late Night with David Letterman, and The Gong Show. He also did cartoon voices for animated versions of The Addams Family and Scooby-Doo and appeared as himself in Wayne's World 2. I'm Archie Zaraletta.
Female rap sensation Lizzo has logged her sixth week atop the Billboard Hot 100 with her song Truth Hurts. And she tells CBS this morning that she's come to terms with her own body shaming about her weight.
I think it's because I learned to actually look all of my insecurities in the face, call them by their name, and fall in love with them.
And she describes herself as a big girl, says her musical success is a testament to the insecurities do not have to kill your dreams. Best friends set me down in the salon chair. Shampoo press get you out of my hair. Fresh photos with the. You've been listening to International Edition. That's our show for today. Find us anytime though at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
This is